like that, we can't say very soft beating on the back or something like that.
Yeah,
or put, for example, a soil on the forehead or something like that. Do you have such rituals? You can't.
Well, obviously, when they beat in, they have the blades at the end, obviously, the knives and the blades, which is tatbir.
Okay,
tatbir. Which is forbidden.
That's a forbidden one, okay.
But obviously, yes, it was there and has 100 years old, you know, history over there. But apart from that, obviously, people, they obviously, you know, they participate. There's a lot of money which has been spent on the tabarruk, you know, the food and the drink, which has been distributed amongst the people.
Okay.
And obviously, there are different things in different cultures we can see.
But people are different and the people's understanding is different. For example, when you have an illiterate population, as the people who are on the minbar listening to you, you cannot talk philosophically about the, for example, true message of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. I mean, your way into their mind must be very much different, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. But I think one of the areas where we should accept diversity to a certain extent, this is the area, right? Mm-hmm. The diversity which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He accepted for human beings.
Yes.
In other words, there are certain individuals, they're different levels of knowledge, they're different levels of intellectual, the intellectual stage are different.
Yes.
So you can't really put everyone in the same ball or, as we say in Farsi. Yeah. But the same applies when it comes to, for example, even rituals as well. Mm-hmm. Like, diversity is embraced here as long as it doesn't contradict Islamic teachings, right?
Okay.
If people want to read poetry in Urdu, for example, or read poetry in Arabic, Farsi, I don't know, Danish, English, whatever you can think of, we should embrace that diversity as long as the aims and the goals are being achieved without us compromising on Islamic teachings, right? So I think that's... And we should be very careful because this is one of the areas where we become very stubborn and a bit sensitive, because normally when we talk about diversity, we talk about the diversity in the Western context where all sorts of corruption are being legitimized and completely justified through that concept of diversity, where true diversity is being put aside and put under the rug, like, for example, this type of diversity, which is beautiful.
Yes.
And it should be there. So I think we should let people have that diversity when we visit different communities. I've personally taken that approach myself. Mm-hmm. There are certain things or rituals maybe I don't understand within the certain cultures of Shia Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as they don't contradict the Islamic teachings and at the same time are reviving the true message of Abu Abdullah alayhi salam, who am I to come and pass a judgment based on the way that I was raised myself, as long as it doesn't contradict the Islamic teachings?
Okay.
So this is one of the places where we should embrace diversity, if you ask me, as long as it doesn't...
Can you remember any Danish poetry about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam?
Yeah, we have Danish poetry about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
What is it? Can you read that for us?
No, English? I'm not. I'm very bad at poetry, so I'm better at lecturing.
Okay.
So
I'll
let the poets recite the poetry, inshallah, and I recite the lectures.
Okay, that's right. Thank you very much. Okay, thank you much, Sheikh. It was very kind of you, Sheikh Muhammad Khani and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. It was very kind of proper understanding of the morning rituals done for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam during the month of Muharram. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us in another episode. God bless you. Afi aman Allah.
Allahumma ja'al mahya ya mahya محمد وآل محمد ومماتي ممات محمد وآل محمد.
Oh, Hussein, you live forever in our hearts and in our minds.
Oh, Hussein, forever
in our hearts and in our minds.
I swear to Allah, unto my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Hussein, you live forever in our hearts and in our minds.
swear to Allah, you have shown us so much courage through the pain. You sacrificed your family and were killed thirsty for Hussein.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights through the Battle of Karbala and the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi al-salam. Now, me and you, we know that Imam al-Hussein alayhi al-salam, he took a handful of companions with him in his journey. According to most of the narrations, it says there were about 72 of his companions with him and about 23 of his family members. There were a mixture of people in that camp of the Imam. You had the Arabs, you had the Turks, you had non-Arabs, you had Muslims, you had newly converted to Christians, you had the old, you had the young, you had the white, you had the black, you had the free men, you have the slaves. It was a mixture of people. It was a boat full of different people. What's interestingly, or what's highly noticeable in this whole mixture, is that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, him being the son of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, the only grandson of the Prophet on the entire earth, he was the holiest man walking the plains of this world. And he had his sons, right? Ali al-Akbar alayhi salam and his brother al-Abbas and his other sons. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, he never looked at himself as superior to any of them, to the Arabs or the Arabs, to the whites or to the blacks. And he did not favor his family over his companions. He did not say, well, Ali al-Akbar is my son, he's the most lookalike to the Prophet, therefore he is better than John, who is a black servant. He never did that. He treated everyone exactly the same. From day one until they got killed one by one, or martyred, I should say, one by one, he would treat them the same as his own sons, as his own brothers, without any single difference. And as I will give you the example. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam, for example, when he looks at Ali al-Akbar, his son, and after Ali al-Akbar went to battle and he fell to the ground, he would go to him and Imam Hussein would pick him up and he would put his cheeks against the cheeks of his son Ali al-Akbar, and he would, you know, talk to him and cry. He'd done the same thing with John, a black servant, and he would pick him up and he would do the same. He would hug him and he would put his cheeks on his cheeks. So he did not discriminate between any of his companions and his family members. He treated them all the same. This is what we call equality between people. This is what we call equality in terms of not trying to be prejudiced, not trying to be racist, not trying to favor people over others. He had his best of companions, like Habib, like old companions, compared to newly companions who joined his club or joined his army, like the likes of Wahab. He never made distinction between any of his companions. They were all to him the same. And that is the best of human rights that we can exercise today when it comes to different races and different colors. Before we get into the topic of racism and discrimination, let us take a short break and then we'll continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We said that Imam Hussein did not discriminate or show racism between any of his companions and his family members. In fact, he treated them all the same. Me and you, we live in a world where discrimination and racism runs this entire world. And sometimes I and you can find ourselves in the same position without realizing it subconsciously. Because sometimes, on the lowest form of things, sometimes I take too much pride of my own country, of my own people, of my own village, of my own city, of my own, I don't know, even lineage or family name. And I think we are better than the rest. We take too much pride in who we are as a nation or as a country, that we make ourselves superior to others. And you can see this happening across the globe in every country where they always see themselves as better than other people. This is like, and this is on the, you know, the tip of the iceberg. And as you go down, you'll see that we discriminate even furthermore when it comes, for example, to black and white, when it comes to color. And until today, even in countries and systems where they pride themselves in human rights and in justice, you see that black people, they still don't have rights. And therefore, we have the movement that Black Lives Matter. When you look at the U.S., for example, and you see that the most of the people in prison are black people. Most of the people are prosecuted are black people. Most people are suffering in America are black people. And same thing in France, same thing in other countries of the world. Black people looked at as secondary class human beings. And the people discriminate against them. We as Muslims have been told that there is no difference between a black person and a white person. The only difference between them is taqwa, piety. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he exercised that to the best. He put that into practice. When he dealt with his black companions, he treated them the same way he would treat his own son or his own brothers. Absolutely no difference between them. When he looked at different races, for example, as we said, he did not say, well, okay, he's an American and this guy is Russian or this guy is Turks or this guy, I don't know, from Europe, therefore I'm going to give them different treatment. He never done that. While today we see people discriminate against people based on the color of the hair and the color of the skin and their eyes, as you guys heard the Ukrainian president when he said, well, these are not Middle Eastern people, they are blondes. And many people said the same statement. So because they're blondes, they have blue eyes and green eyes, they have better chances or they should be treated differently than me who has a brown face and brown skin and have dark hair and dark eyes. See the discrimination here? Even based on the color of our eyes and the color of our skin, we can discriminate against one another. To Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, there's no difference between me and you. The only difference is how much I am submitting to Allah and how much you are submitting to Allah. Beside that, nothing else is different. And what is a better way to learn this through the school of Karbala, the University of Karbala, when you look at Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and you look at how he dealt with everyone exactly the same, without discrimination, without racism, without any prejudice, without him saying, well, I am the grandson of the Prophet and everyone is below me. Never did he do that. So we need to go back to Karbala and learn the basics of human rights. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
In the limelight. Former U.S. President Donald Trump is under criminal investigation for potential violations of the Espionage Act and additional statutes relating to obstruction of justice and destroying federal government records. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled Trump under investigation for potential violations of Espionage Act, warrant reveals. Former U.S. President Donald Trump is under criminal investigation for potential violations of the Espionage Act and additional statutes relating to obstruction of justice and destroying federal government records. According to the search warrant executed by FBI agents at the former president's home on Monday, 8th of August. The search warrant, the contents of which were confirmed by The Guardian, shows the FBI was seeking evidence about whether the mishandling of classified documents by Donald Trump, including some marked top secret, amounted to violation of three criminal statutes. Most notably, the search warrant authorized FBI agents to seize materials from Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence to investigate crimes in connection with the Espionage Act, which outlaws the unauthorized retention of national security information that could harm the United States or aid an adversary. The other statutes listed on the warrant include the federal law that makes it a crime to destroy or conceal a document in order to obstruct a government investigation, and the federal law that prohibits the unlawful removal of government documents more generally. The inclusion of the obstruction statute could be an indication that the Justice Department is investigating Donald Trump not just over the potentially unlawful retention of records, but also whether he attempted to impede a separate or wider criminal inquiry. The disclosures, which came in an attachment to the search warrant, mark a dramatic escalation in the Justice Department's criminal inquiries into Donald Trump. They represent perhaps one of the most treacherous legal and political moments faced to date by the former president. A conviction for violating any of the detailed laws would be severe. The Espionage Act has a maximum penalty of 10 years in federal prison, and the statute for obstruction has a maximum penalty of 20 years, while the statute for destruction of records can also bar anyone convicted from holding future office. The contents of the search warrant became public days after FBI agents seized 11 boxes worth of materials from Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in Palm Beach, Florida, including records considered so sensitive that they could not be individually listed in the receipt of what was removed. The most sensitive set of documents removed from Trump's post-presidency home in Florida were listed generically as various classified TSSCI, the abbreviation for Top Secret Sensitive Compartmented Information, the warrant shows. FBI agents retrieved a total of 11 sets of classified documents, some of which were marked Top Secret, the Wall Street Journal first reported. Federal agents also took away 4 sets of Top Secret documents, 3 sets of Secret documents, and 3 sets of Confidential documents, the receipt showed. The search warrant receipt did not provide any further detail about the substance of the classified documents. Other materials removed from Mar-a-Lago include binders of photographs, information on the President of France, and a grant of clemency for the Trump political operative Roger Stone. Caught at the center of a rapidly escalating controversy, Donald Trump lashed out at the Justice Department on Friday, 12th of August, saying in a statement that he had declassified all of the records in question. It was all declassified, Trump asserted. The former president's claim was met with immediate skepticism, partly because the seized documents appeared to retain their original classified markings, according to a source familiar with the matter, who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss an open investigation. Donald Trump has offered no details about how the supposed declassification took place, and a former Trump administration aide, Kash Patel, has said that even though Donald Trump did declassify the records, the White House counsel's office never provided the required paperwork. But whether the former president actually declassified the documents may not ultimately matter. The Espionage Act, for instance, does not distinguish between classified and declassified materials. Unauthorized retention of any document relevant to the statute remains a crime. Documents marked as top secret are also meant only to be viewed in secure rooms known as a Sensitive Compartmented Information Facilities, or SCIF, and their presence in a basement storage area at Mar-a-Lago appears to satisfy the technical elements of a violation of law. In a statement, the House Intelligence Committee chairman, Adam Schiff, said the classified documents found at Mar-a-Lago were a potential security issue. Every day that information of such a classification sits in an unsecure location is a risk to our national security, Adam Schiff said. The protection of classified information, and particularly the protection of sources and methods, is an issue of the highest priority for the intelligence community. And as we learn more, we will responsibly discharge our oversight responsibilities, Adam Schiff said. The committee, the California Democrat chairs, oversees the FBI as well as other federal law enforcement agencies. Calls and texts to Donald Trump's lawyers and aides went unreturned after the contents of the warrant became public on Friday, 12th of August. A spokesperson for the U.S. Justice Department declined to comment. The disclosure of the contents of the search warrant and the receipt came hours before the deadline for Donald Trump and his legal team, led by Evan Corcoran, to oppose a motion by the Justice Department to make public both documents, which are no longer under seal. The motion to unseal, announced by Attorney General Merrick Garland in prepared remarks at the Justice Department on Thursday, does not currently include the affidavit accompanying the warrant that would give greater detail on the probable cause that led to the approval of the Mar-a-Lago raid.
Faqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. There are many blessings and benefits in paying visit to the holy tombs of the infallibles. The late Ayatollah Behjat used to visit the tomb of Lady Fatima al-Masuma in the city of Qom for 7 years every day. Also, the late Imam Khomeini used to visit the tomb of Imam Ali alayhi salam for 15 years when he was exiled in Najaf. Also, the late Haji Aga Hussain Qommi used to visit the tomb of Lady Fatima al-Masuma in the city of Qom every day.
¶¶
قبور خیلی چیزها داره برای اهلش.
The holy tombs of Ahlul Bayt have many blessings for their visitors. As you might know, the holy grave of Hazrat Fatima is unknown. Thus, we must benefit from the blessings of the tomb of Lady Masuma in Qom. Allah made the grave of Hazrat Masuma hidden. However, He sent His blessings upon the grave of Lady Masuma so that the people can benefit from her blessings. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, which was the English translation of a short Persian speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the qualities of, where we are discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we are currently focusing on the 16th sermon, where after discussing about the issue of the strategy that he had in mind for the society, for changing the Muslim Ummah, he talks about the reality of truth and falsehood. He talks about what is truth, what is falsehood, what are the criteria, how it is important for a person to be aware of the truth and of the falsehood, so that he can take the right things. This is a very important factor, and we say that for the right change to happen in a society, it's not just enough to feel difficulties and problems and the pressure and the constriction and the oppression. Feeling it is one thing. taking the right step after that is another thing. And even then, when you talk about feeling the problem, you need to feel the actual problem to realize what is the problem exactly. And then find a solution based on right and correct principles towards the right direction. And this is the thing that Imam Ali did. People faced the difficulties. Imam Ali alayhi salam reminded them of what that real difficulty is. Imam Ali alayhi salam reminded them of what that really real difficulty is. And then after that, he gave them what is the right solution for that, the right direction to take after that.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We are discussing about the importance of recognizing the truth and the falsehood so that a person can take the right direction in their lives. And that is the role of Imam Ali alayhi salam, where he showed the people the direction of truth. And he warned the people of the falsehood. When coming to a society, you know, in a society, there are many people with different potentials, different abilities, different strengths. There are people that have the power to think. There are people who have the power to analyze. There might be some scholars in that society and in that community that can guide and take that community in a certain direction. But many times, and this doesn't happen, many times these potentials remain underground. These potentials are not allowed to flourish. And that is because there is no leadership ahead, no right form of leadership that can awaken these hidden potentials and use them in the right direction to guide these trapped energy that exists in that community and in this society. So when Imam Ali alayhi salam takes over the leadership, when the people recognize that, you know, it is this particular man, Imam Ali alayhi salam, with that insight and depth that he has regarding people, regarding the truth, regarding what is false, who can really show us our direction in a way that those inner potentials can flourish, can come out and can materialize in this world and take us towards the direction of truth. And this presence of Imam Ali alayhi salam was very important, especially in the leadership position, because it is in that position that he can clearly guide, direct, command, and kind of create that movement that is required for this change to happen, for these potentials to flourish, and for them to kind of get that direction and materialization. But if Imam Ali alayhi salam was not in that leadership position and he was just staying in the Muslim Ummah, sometimes he wouldn't get the opportunity to say all that is necessary for the community to be successful and to enter into the right direction.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Sometimes when you are present, welcome back dear listeners. We are discussing of the fact that Imam Ali alayhi salam, taking that leadership position now, had that opportunity to make the people recognize what is the truth and what is falsehood. Because the people already felt that difficulty, that problem, the wrongness that was happening in the previous, the governments. And therefore, people were ready. But as I said previously, that just feeling the pain is not important. Feeling it in the correct way, recognizing that problem is the actual thing. recognizing that pain. And who will make you recognize that pain? That pain? The leader. The leader will show you that this is the actual pain that you have. And once he tells you that, that is not enough. The leaders will also tell you what direction you need to take. What is that true path to traverse to be able to find the solution to that problem. And this is when Imam Ali alayhi salam takes over the leadership. And that is why that leadership of Imam Ali alayhi salam was very, very important. Such that, people from various parts of the Muslim Ummah, especially those who had that pain, that difficulty, and they felt those problems. Now when they saw Imam Ali alayhi salam giving those guidelines, they were there to support him. They were there to give their lives for him. People like Malik Ashtar, people like the people that came from Egypt as a delegation, who had these difficulties and problems. When they realized that Imam Ali alayhi salam is taking this path, they quickly followed the path, and they saw the blessings that came out of that, and the growth and the progress that was achieved as a result of following the directions of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So Imam Ali alayhi salam had a mammoth task to kind of recoil that wrong training that had happened in the previous governments. And this role was quite difficult. It meant that there was supposed to be a lot of efforts to be taken and many toes to be stepped on. And of course, a brave person like Imam Ali alayhi salam took this role, and he managed to handle it in the best way that a human being can possibly can. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The U.S. Justice Department says FBI agents have found 11 sets of classified documents, with some marked as top secret, in Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida while executing a search warrant this week. The warrant was publicly released following a federal judge's order. It states investigators had probable cause to believe Trump violated three federal crimes, including violating the Espionage Act, obstruction of justice, and criminal handling of the government records. Media reports say the FBI search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago home was for possible classified materials related to U.S. nuclear weapons. Trump, however, rejected that. He called it a hoax and claimed he had no stored classified information. The unprecedented raid on the residence of the former U.S. president provoked a backlash from leading Republicans who described the move as politically motivated. The Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, said the search of Trump's property was another escalation in the weaponization of federal agencies against the regime's political opponents. Also, Florida Senator Marco Rubio stated that Biden is using his power to persecute Trump. But the White House has denied the allegations, saying it was unaware of the search before it happened. Moreover, there have been growing threats in recent days against FBI agents and offices across the country. On Thursday, a man who tried to breach the FBI's Cincinnati office was shot and killed by police after he fled the scene. Law enforcement officials say the man may have been present at the January 6th riot. Right after news of the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago broke, there was a big spike in tweets referencing civil war. Analysts and reporters say this is alarmingly similar to the activities in the lead-up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
Well, I think it's true that there are people in the permanent national security wing of the U.S. government who don't want Trump to return to office. And whether or not those people are currently raiding Trump in Mar-a-Lago in order to try to get proof of crimes they could use to charge him and put him in a position where he legally can't run for office.
Shockwaves spread across America in response to the news that the FBI had searched the private Florida residence of Donald Trump. It prompted threats of retaliation from the former U.S. president and his allies. The surge in violent rhetoric drew concerns that it could lead to civil unrest and a social crisis. Department of Homeland Security officials have been warning for months that this type of warlike rhetoric, which came to fruition on January 6th and which continues to be fueled by reactions to ongoing investigations of Trump, is increasing the risk of more widespread political violence ahead of the midterm elections in November. This comes as recent polls have shown a rising acceptance of political violence among Americans. About 1 in 3 Americans say they believe violence against the government can at times be justified. According to another study by researchers at the University of California Davis Violence Prevention Research Program and the California Violence Research Center released last month, more than half of Americans expect that a civil war will erupt in the U.S. sometime in the next few years.
I think it is a sign that the U.S. Polarization has gotten way out of hand and could be leading to a constitutional crisis and possible civil war or social breakdown kind of situation. We have seen this polarization growing for many years.
Meanwhile, as much as 40% of election and poll workers in the largest jurisdictions in the U.S. have so far said they won't be returning to their jobs out of their own fears. Other states are seeing drop-offs too. Nearly 1 in 3 local election workers said they felt unsafe because of their jobs. The alarming partisan divide within the U.S. political system ahead of the vital midterm elections in November had raised concerns over the possibility of internal conflict.
Tensions are still high between China and Taiwan. The flare-up comes days after the provocative visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the island. Officials in Chinese Taipei have rejected the one-country, two-systems plan proposed by China for the self-ruled island. Taipei says that only the Taiwanese can decide the island's future. The reaction came after China published a white paper on Taiwan, which Beijing says shows the resolute determination of Beijing to peacefully resolve the unification issue. The paper lays out China's position on the self-ruled island. It says Beijing would never allow any attempt to separate Taiwan, but also would make every effort to achieve unification through peaceful means. Taiwan has accused Beijing of using House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit as, quote, an excuse to destroy the status quo. Pelosi visited the island on August 2nd, despite vehement protests from China.
What they want to do with Taiwan is fight. U.S. wants to fight China to the last Taiwanese. If not to the last Japanese, if not enough, then to the last Korean. Ultimately, the U.S. will not fight the wars. It will finance them. It will give weapons. It will antagonize us. It will antagonize both sides. And that's what they want to do. And it's actually a replica to the World War II.
Beijing reacted with an unprecedented burst of military around the island. The drills lasted for several days. Taiwan has also launched live fire drills in the wake of China's largest ever military exercises. The white paper issued by China this week was the third document of its kind over Taiwan. The previous editions were the Taiwan Question and Reunification of China, which was published in 1993, and the One China Principle and the Taiwan Question, which came out in 2000. China insists differences in the social systems in mainland and Taiwan are, quote, neither an obstacle to reunification nor a justification for secessionism. But Beijing says it will not rule out the military option to achieve such reunification.
What China wants to do with this white paper is just to find a way with Taiwan to get it back to its sense, because reunification will happen. The problem is that if it doesn't happen peacefully, it will happen by force. China doesn't want to do it by force, but it's being pushed on the corner by the U.S. because the U.S. is actually slowly declaring Taiwan independent.
Speaker Pelosi's controversial visit has undermined the One China policy, which is recognized by nearly all countries of the international community, including the United States. Under the policy, the international community recognizes Taiwan as part of China, and the U.S. is committed to recognizing and having formal ties with China rather than the island of Taiwan. But Washington, contrary to its stated policy, continues to undermine China's sovereignty and courts the secessionist government in Taipei.
So what is the one country, two system? It was applied actually the first time is in Hong Kong. And so since the handover in 1997, they applied the one country, two system. The way it was done in Hong Kong was that Hong Kong could keep its a very high degree of autonomy. And actually they did it for Hong Kong. And it was a way, a showcase that they could show to Taiwan to say, well, in case you were to reunify with the mainland, this would be the system.
China has proposed the one country, two systems model to win Taiwan back. The policy allowed the Chinese government to successfully solve the question of Hong Kong through diplomatic negotiations with the British government. Hong Kong was under colonial British rule since the 19th century. China resumed to exercise its sovereignty over the island on July 1, 1997.
But what happened in Hong Kong was that you had the external forces. You had a massive amount of money being poured by NED, National Endowment for Democracy, and you had the usual suspect, the whole team of regime change working for the US, the MI6, and they did everything to destroy the one country, two system in Hong Kong, and that ended up with the riots. And then in 2020, you had the national security law.
Under the model, offshore regions like Hong Kong remain under China's sovereignty but can retain their own economic and administrative systems. Now China insists the same model could be applied to Taiwan.
Iran is making giant leaps in its peaceful space program. Iran has just launched its Khayyam satellite into orbit. The satellite was sent into space from the Moscow-operated Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. Khayyam satellite was sent into orbit on Tuesday by Soyuz 2.1B rocket. Iran says it will also use imagery from Khayyam to monitor Iran's borders and improve the country's capabilities in management and planning in the fields of agriculture, natural resources, environment, mining, and natural disasters. After all, Iran is surrounded by US bases, and terrorists have preyed on Iran to enter its soil to conduct terrorist operations. Contrary to claims made by Western media outlets, Tehran insists the Khayyam satellite is fully controlled by Iranian experts and technicians based inside Iran from the very beginning of its launch. However, not everyone is happy about this satellite launch. The US expressed anger at Iran's partnership with Russia and accused Iran that the aim of the satellite is spying, something Iran has categorically rejected. The US has said they suspected that the satellite could be used by Moscow to spy on troop movements in Ukraine. Yet, Iran is resolute in its cooperation with Russia. It has said it will continue production of such satellites with Russia, adding that it's a great honor for Iranian technicians to work alongside Russian technicians who have more than 6 decades of experience in the field.
Yes, well, the US government, of course, is particularly concerned about this. It really, in many respects, it should have seen this coming. It should have seen cooperation between states that it has under attack coming. But the arrogance, I think, of the US in particular, of Washington in particular, blinds it to these sorts of developments. They could ignore the fact, for example, that small states like Syria, like Cuba, were able to cooperate together. But when large states like Iran and Russia cooperate together, there's the inevitability. There's going to be new developments which free those countries, those peoples, from the domination of the US.
The launch of Khayyam satellite has been hailed as, quote, an important milestone in Russian-Iranian bilateral cooperation that paves the way for implementing new joint projects. It has ushered what Iran has dubbed as its strategic aerospace cooperation between Tehran and Moscow. Russia now says it's open to cooperation in the field of space exploration with all interested countries and partners, specifically Iran. The launch is also seen as a major achievement for Iran, despite Western sanctions.
Okay, so it's very important. The cooperation between Iran and Russia in satellite technology is very important because it shows a cooperation between large states with great capacity, which are both under economic blockade by Washington in particular. I would say Washington rather than the West, because really there are some mixed feelings in some parts of other Western countries. But certainly Washington is very jealous of any sort of independent achievement by Iran or Russia.
Iran says Western sanctions cannot stop its scientific progress. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has said that the successful launch of this satellite is a great achievement for Iran. This comes as Iran has made significant achievements in the field of science and technology in recent years. Earlier this year, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Aerospace Force launched its second homegrown satellite into a low Earth orbit nearly 2 years after the launch of its first military satellite. The IRGC successfully put Nur 2 or Light 2 into orbit on March the 8th. Iran has already mastered the technology to build remote sensing satellites with an image resolution of 5 to 10 meters and can inject up to 50 kilogram packages into an orbit of 500 kilometers. But Khayyam can hit a much more precise resolution of 1 meter. Iran aims to achieve the technology to put a 100-kilogram satellite into the 500-kilometer orbit by next year.
Ten years have passed since the start of war in Syria, but the country still seems to be in the midst of a conflict. So who's fighting who, and why does this seem like a war without end? For years, the Syrian war was the biggest news story, but now not so much. Cities and railways are being rebuilt, domestic flights have even started up again. Meanwhile, foreign forces have, on the other hand, ramped up their efforts to push their own agenda. The UNHCR even says the amount of investment to fuel the ongoing crisis compared to the money to alleviate the impact of the war on the Syrian people is very little. When the war started, Syrian government forces fought against US and foreign-backed terrorists. The US, its allies such as the UK and France, as well as Saudi Arabia and others, sided with the opposition and supported these terrorists. But Syria's legitimate government also had its own allies, namely Russia and Iran. Amid the ongoing chaos, terrorists took advantage of the crisis and soon became a common enemy to everyone. Now, over the course of the years of conflict, Daesh continues to operate in northern Syria with the help of the US to achieve its own goals at the cost of the Syrian people. The US has been accused of both hiring terrorists and training them to destabilize the country. This comes while a large portion of Northeast Syria's crude oil resources have fallen onto the hands of the U.S. So does this confirm that the U.S. is in one way or another fueling the conflict to continue its illegal occupation and abuse of Syrian resources?
The big question is what